So it's a pleasure to be here. And so this talk is based on some results that have been going on this semester and hopefully should come out by next week. It's been quite a work in progress, but now, I mean, the results are quite sharp. So I'm going to present you quite a lot of them, and whatever we get through, we'll see. And if I don't get through everything, then that's not a problem. So the motivation is that we're going to talk about Wilson loops for a certain class of 5D theories. What is a Wilson loop? It's a non-local operator in gauge theory, and it encodes the essential aspects of the strongly coupled regime. And so the data to specify a Wilson loop is the, since it's a trace of a holonomy matrix, where a quark is parallel transported along a closed curve, you have to tell me what the curve is in space-time, and you have to specify a representation of the gauge group, and that's it. That's the data defining your Wilson loop. And so here in this talk, as I said, we're going to look at some supersymmetric 5D gauge theories with half BPS Wilson loop, meaning that the Wilson loop will break half the supersymmetry, and then we'll see that for the particular class of Wilson loops I'm looking at, there is a nice story where you can reinterpret these Wilson loops in a 3D gauge theory language and also in terms of deformed W algebras. So specifically, the 5D supersymmetric gauge theories I'm talking about have 8 supercharges, or n equal 1 supersymmetry, and they're defined on C2 cross a circle of radius r hat. And so here, for an appetizer, let me tell you a little bit what is known. As for UN gauge theory, one way to introduce half BPS Wilson lines is using a one-dimensional fermion field, which I'll call chi, which transforms into fundamental representation of UN, coupled to the 5D gauge field in the bulk as follows. So in your 5D Yang-Mills action, you can just add an extra term if you want, which couples the 5D bulk to the Wilson loop physics through the inclusion of this fermion. So this was already done some years ago in a paper by Gomis and Passerini. And here, so what I call AT and phi are the pullback of the 5D gauge field and the adjoint scalar of the vector multiplet. And this M is a background gauge field for the U1 symmetry that acts on the fermions. Put differently, it's the mass term for the fermions. Sets the energy scale for the excitation of the quark. Could I say fermion or quark interchangeably? And so what Gomis and Passerini showed, in fact, is that the path integral of the coupled system, 5D, 1D, is in fact a generating function of Wilson loops. So if you actually compute the path integral of the combined 5D, 1D system, where by this psi here I mean collectively all 5D fields, and the chi here is the fermion field that you introduce, and so you integrate over psi and chi, then the partition function can be written as a generating function. So this is a polynomial in this variable z, where z is defined here as exponential of the fermion mass. And it's a finite polynomial of degree, the rank of the gauge group. And the coefficient in this polynomial are precisely Wilson loop expectation values in all representation that are anti-symmetric. So you're summing over all anti-symmetric representations. And so that, by definition, we'll say is a generating function of Wilson loops over all fundamental representations. So that was the result. And so here what I want to ask, and that will be the first result in this talk, is what happens when the quark moves in the presence of instantons. So instantons in 4 dimensions are solutions of the self-dual Yang-Mills equation. And so here, because I'm working in 5 dimensions, you have to think of, again, 5D as a circle times your space-time. So the instanton live in that space-time part. The circle, there's no instanton on the circle part. And so the presence of the Wilson lines is expected to generalize the dynamics of instantons, because you can think of a quark as an electrically charged particle and an instanton as a magnetically charged particle. And so now the two put together, when your instanton moves in the presence of a quark, it experiences an electromagnetic Lorentz force. So the endeavor understanding the dynamics of instanton in the presence of this quark that travels in a loop was actually only initiated very recently. There's a series of papers by Tong, And then more recently, Nekrasov and Kim computed the partition function of Yang Mills in the presence of a quark moving in the exact same Wilson loop I'm discussing. So here my loop is a quark moving along the circle in 5D, right? So the 5D is compactified on a circle. So the quark path is that circle, and it sits at the origin of the C2, the origin of spacetime. That's to preserve supersymmetry. We'll come back to this. But in particular, computing the partition function in that background for a single gauge group UN was done by Kim, and a different construction was given by Nekrasov. We'll come back to this in a second. And so what happens is that even when you consider all the instanton possible correction in Yang-Mills, and you compute the partition function, actually the 5D-1D coupled system is still a polynomial, finite polynomial in the exponential of the fermion mass, again with coefficients that are Wilson loop expectation values in fundamental representation, but this time these guys are much more complicated, of course, because now instead of just having a character of SU whatever, then you have instead now instanton corrections, an infinite number of them on each one of these coefficients. So nonetheless, if you don't care, I mean, if you just sum it up completely, as a function of Z, of the fermion mass, the partition function is a polynomial, finite polynomial. In particular, it's highly non-trivial to prove that this expression has no poles in Z, but it's one of the results. We'll come back to this. So this was for one single gauge group, UN, and this is what has been done. What I want to do today, as a first part of this talk, is to generalize this analysis to a large class of 5D quiver gauge theories. We'll see that these quiver gauge theories are labeled by a simple Lie algebra, simple. And then we'll reinterpret the results in three dimensions, where connection to deformed W algebras will become natural. And our starting point will be type 2B string theory. So let's start. Yes.
What was small n?
Small n is the rank of UN. So UN is the 5D Yang-Mills. So for definiteness, let's do some perturbative type 2B on this following background. So here I'm compactifying type 2B on a Riemann surface, which for this talk will be a cylinder. For the purpose of this talk, all I can talk about is either the complex plane, a cylinder, or a torus. In particular, the cylinder will capture most of the essential physics. So we'll talk about the cylinder. Times C2, that will be our space-time, if you want. And a resolved ADE singularity. So C is an infinite cylinder. And this resolved ADE singularity, well, these singularities, they're labeled by a discrete subgroup of SU2, this gamma of G, which are classified, are known from mathematics to have an ADE classification. So what I mean by this is that if I give you an AN singularity, you can resolve it by blowing up the singularities, and they look like a bunch of P1s that touch each other according to the Dynkin diagram of AN, or if you have a dihedral singularity, then you'll have formed the Dynkin diagram of DN, or you can also have the Dynkin diagram of E6, E7, or E8, if I give you an E6, E7, or E8 singularity. And the McKay correspondence tells you that there is a one-to-one correspondence between the representation theory of the Lie algebra G and the geometry of the resolved singularity. For instance, the roots in the root lattice in the Lie algebra G are in one-to-one correspondence with compact two cycles, the P1s, so literally these P1s are labeled, for instance, by the simple roots of the Lie algebra, positive simple roots. And so the compact two cycles in the second homology group of X are in one-to-one correspondence with the roots. And the weights, similarly, in the weight lattice, are in one-to-one correspondence with non-compact two cycles in the second relative homology group of X. So this is allowing boundaries at infinity. Okay, so an element in this homology group can look basically like a cigar. You're not requiring to be a compact thing. It can extend to infinity and have a boundary at infinity. Okay, so if I consider type 2B on this AD background, I have 16 supercharges. And ultimately, I'm interested in the dynamics of five-dimensional gauge theories with 8 supercharges. That's where, basically, with 16 supercharges, there's too much supersymmetry for me to compute things, well, as we'll see. So that's why my interest is in a little bit less supersymmetry. So to get to 8 supersymmetries, I need to break supersymmetry by half. And an easy way to do this in type 2b without thinking too much is to just add d-brains. So let's do just that. So now I'm going to add the following d-brains, which right now is going to look mysterious, but we're going to explain everything in parts. So I'm going to add n d5 brains, which are later, this n will be the gauge groups. So we're going to explain why. But these d5 brains will be points on the cylinder, will wrap all the compact 2 cycles of the resolved singularity, and wrap the 2 complex planes. And I'm also going to introduce NF D5 brains that only wrap the non-compact 2 cycles, also sit at points on the cylinder, and wrap the 2 complex planes. Sorry, the 2 real planes or the complex lines, whichever you want to call it. So they wrap the C2. And then I'm going to introduce, and this is where the Wilson loop physics will be entirely encoded, and that will be the essence of this talk. I'm going to introduce D1 brains that only wrap the non-compact 2 cycles of the resolved singularity. And they sit at the origin here, and they are points on the cylinder. If I just consider the D5 brains in the setup I just showed you here, this preserves 8 supercharges indeed. That's easy to show. And then after introducing the D1 brains, the number goes down to 4. So from the point of view of the D5 brains, the D1 brains are like half BPS objects. And actually, we'll see that they're precisely the half BPS Wilson loops that I want to engineer from string theory. But before that, let's put the D1 brains on the side and just talk a little bit about the D5 brain. So the data here that I have for the D5 brains is I'm going to specify the charge of all the D5 brains. And so an easy way to do this is to just choose a class in the second homology group of X to represent the brain charge of the D5 brains that only wrap the compact 2 cycles. And so you can expand it here by abuse of notation. I'm identifying a basis of compact 2 cycle with positive simple roots, and so I'm writing this as alpha A. And so there's a minus sign here for cosmetics, but you can specify a D5 brain charge, compact D5 brain charge, by just expanding in terms of simple roots of your Lie algebra with some positive coefficients NA here, the total brain charge. And likewise, for these red brains, the total brain charge due to for the red D5 brains can be expanded in terms of fundamental weights with also positive coefficients, and that specifies a class in the second relative homology group because they wrap the non-compact 2 cycles. And so you can notice, by the way, that like here the homology pairing that we have here is very analogous to what we call in Lie algebra. In fact, it's one-to-one correspondence with what we call in Lie algebra just the Cartan-Keeling metric, where you have a simple root and a fundamental weight, and you take the Cartan-Keeling metric of one with the other, and you get the delta, Kronecker delta. So I'm going back and forth between the notation between compact 2 cycles and simple roots, and non-compact 2 cycles and fundamental weights. And because of the Mackey correspondence, it's fine to do that. Any questions so far? Okay, so this is what this looks like in the geometry in terms of my variables. This is what I call the eighth compact 2 cycle, and constructed over it as a fiber over the cotangent bundle of the cotangent bundle over some point here that you choose on SA, you can construct an SA star, which is just the non-compact 2 cycle corresponding to the 2 cycle compact SA. Likewise, you can also specify the D1 brain charge. The D1 brains, remember, they only wrap the non-compact 2 cycles here in green, and they don't wrap anything else. And so here, well, because they wrap the non-compact 2 cycles, their brain charge must be specified only in terms of the fundamental weights, because it's also the non-compact 2 cycles, remember, that are in the second relative homology group. And the LA here, again, are positive, and by that I mean zero or strictly positive coefficients. M is the rank of my algebra everywhere, right? So this is just the rank, how many 2 spheres I have. If I have an AM singularity, then you have M fundamental weights. Now, for the purpose of this talk here, what I'm going to do is decouple gravity to make contact with the gauge theory physics. And we can discuss the meaning of this limit further at some point. But here, well, I'll just give you this as like an assumption that what I'm going to do, I'm going to take G string to zero in everything that follows. And so in type 2B string theory on an AD singularity, taking G string to zero has a name. This is actually called studying what's called the 2,0 little string. And here, the little string is a six-dimensional non-critical string theory. And it's defined on whatever's remaining, which is the cylinder times C2. And the D5 brains, from the point of view of that little string, as a side note, are codimension 2 defect, like surface defects. And then the D1 brains that only wrap non-compact to cycles, they look like points in the little string. So they're point defects. So here, from the point of view of little string theory, what we're studying is 2,0 little string with codimension 2 defects and point defects. That's just a side note. It won't be important for what I'm talking about. And then the most important result here is that the low energy theory on the D5 brains is a quiver gauge theory. And that was determined in a seminal paper by Douglas and Moore already a long time ago, more than, 20 years ago. And the quiver gauge theory takes the shape of the Dynkin diagram of the Lie algebra. And so you could expect, you know, if you put a bunch of D brains together, that at low energies, or you know, you're going to get some, you know, so UN or whatever, UM gauge theory. But what Douglas and Moore showed is that no, if you have an ADE singularity, actually what you get is really a quiver gauge theory, or you can think of the P1s as, you get a quiver gauge theory of rank M here in this case. So now let me just discuss for a moment why you really have a 5D theory at low energies and not a 4D theory, because so far what I've described is completely consistent with telling you that you have a 4D n equal 2 theory living on the D5 brains. But really it's a 5D theory on a circle. The reason is the following. Remember, all my D5 brains are points on the cylinder, but by T-duality, you can completely trade this problem for a completely equivalent problem, which is the problem of studying D6 brains wrapping the circle, the T-dual circle of a dual cylinder. And so in this description, now you have a bunch of brains that are wrapping literally a circle. And so here in this description, it's clear that at low energies, I don't have a 4D n equal 2 theory, but I have an honest 5D n equal 1 theory living on the D5 brains. Again, you can think of it as a theory on D6 brains in a T-dual setting, or D5 brains that are points on the cylinder. But the circle basically is felt by the strings. They wrap around the circle of the cylinder, and that's why you have a 5D n equal 1 theory on a circle, as opposed to just a purely 4D n equal 2 theory. Likewise, the D1 brains that were points on the cylinder really do wrap a circle, and that's exactly how these D1 brains, Wilson loops are actually described in string theory. So here they sit at the origin of C2, and they wrap this circle, and so you can actually trace back to the earlier papers, and this is exactly how you engineer a Wilson loop from the point of view of the gauge theory living on the D5 brains. So the theory on the D5 brains, I told you, is a quiver gauge theory, and schematically we denote it like this. It takes, again, the shape of the Dynkin diagram of the algebra. So for instance, if my Lie algebra is an AM Lie algebra, you get a bunch of, we write circles to denote gauge nodes. And so to each gauge node, you associate a collection of vector spaces, V1 through Vm. And between these, there's a collection of maps, homomorphisms, between V1 and V2. In physics, we call these bifundamental hypermultiplets. There's homomorphisms from V1 to some other vector space, W1. In physics, we call this fundamental hypers. And they're denoted by square for the rank of the flavor symmetry associated to it. And the dimension of these vector spaces are what matters in this case for the notation. Here, we just, every one of these numbers denotes the rank of a unitary gauge group. So N1 means U of N1, NF2 means U of NF2, et cetera. So you have just a quiver gauge theory, which is a bunch of unitary gauge groups and a bunch of homomorphisms that are maps between vector spaces associated to it, to all of them. So by fundamentals, fundamental hypers, and vector multiplets. Here's an example and how it looks like in geometry. So here I have a U2 gauge theory times a U1 with three flavors on the, so it would be a U3 flavor symmetry. And so in homology, you'd say that you have a total non-compact D5 brain charge 3 S1 star, that's this three here. And then the compact D5 brain charge total, which I call S as a class in homology, is 2 S1 plus S2, where you have like the S1 class is labeled by this node, and the S2 class is labeled by that node. So that just tells you you have two compact D5 brains wrapping this resolved P1, one compact D5 brain wrapping this P1, and three non-compact D5 brains. And by, okay, it's an abuse again of notation when I say a compact D5 brain, I mean a D5 brain wrapping a compact two cycle. So here's the dictionary from geometry to gauge theory. The position of the non-compact D5 brain on the cylinder are mass parameters of the low energy quiver gauge theory. The positions of the compact D5 brains on the cylinder are the Coulomb moduli of the 5D gauge theory. The gauge couplings and Fi parameters, Fi Eliopoulos parameters, they come from various moduli of the metric on the resolved AD singularity and the spacetimes Ramon-Ramon and NSNS B fields. And the position of the D1 brains on C are the fermion masses that I introduced at the beginning, this parameter Z, e to the fermion mass. That precisely is the coordinates. So the position of the D1 brains on C, I will identify this as the fermion masses, since the D1 brains are Wilson loops. And so here the fermion sky that I introduced at the very beginning in this coupled 5D1D action, here they are. These fermion chi, they arise in string theory by quantizing the D1, D5 strings. Strings that stretch between D1 brains and D5 brains result in fermion excitations, and the coupling to 5D from 1D precisely should produce this term for a given gauge group. Okay? And so that's just the dictionary. And then I'm going to generalize a little bit further. This is a little bit more esoteric and hasn't been studied much, if at all. But the first paper goes back to 96 by Aspinwall and Gross. From the type 2B framework we presented, there is a way to generalize and construct what they called 5D non-simply laced gauge theories. So what is meant by that is a construction, and here is the conjecture for the procedure, if you want. Take this as a definition. Okay, I'm not saying this is, but this is how you define from string theory, from this paper, in fact, and then this was revisited 2 years ago by Kimura and Pestun, exactly in our context, how you construct a non-simply laced gauge theory. So what I mean by that is that now as you go around one of the two complex planes in your space-time, you let the resolved AD singularity come back to itself, but up to the action of a generator of the outer automorphism group of the ADE Lie algebra. So there's some outer automorphism group action that exists for AD and E6. And so you can act with this outer automorphism group. And here, to have a well-defined theory, the only requirement I want really is that the D5 and the D1 brains that I started with in my setup, in my resolved ADE singularity, remain invariant under this autoautomorphism group action. Okay, so if I have a configuration of D5 and D1 brains that's invariant after I act with the autoautomorphism group action, then the claim is that you can produce a quiver, if you want, a gauge theory defined as follows. All the various fields on the brains are only well-defined now on the R-fold cover of the complex plane, where R is the order of the autoautomorphism group. And the D5 and the D1 brain charge should now be understood in terms of co-roots and co-weights instead of roots and weights, because, I mean, that's what's invariant. In non-simply laced language, a root and a co-root are not the same, and so actually if you want to be very rigorous, everything should be written in terms of co-roots and co-weights of the algebra, not roots and weights. So this is what it looks like in the picture. You pick one of the two complex planes. Which one you pick does matter. The physics is different if you pick the other one. And as you go around the origin of that complex plane, you let the D5 and D1 brains rotate, like the two cycles will be rotated. But as long as the configuration is invariant under this rotation, then you can make sense of a non-simply laced quiver gauge theory. Here are the outer automorphism group actions. If I have a DM plus one Lie algebra, for instance, there is what's called the Z2 action on the outer nodes here, the spinner nodes. And out of this, you can produce an algebra, which is called the BM algebra. For instance, you have also a Z3 outer automorphism group action on a D4 Dynkin diagram, which produces G2. Because the outer automorphism group action on the Lie algebra is in one-to-one correspondence with the symmetries of the Dynkin diagram of the Lie algebra itself. So here, that's why you can just draw the Dynkin diagram and from it infer what the auto-automorphism group action looks like. So here's what this would look like, for instance, what we'd call a B2 quiver gauge theory. So here you should really think of the 2 as the rank of a U2 gauge node. This will denote a long simple root, and this will denote a node denoting the short simple root. Long roots are invariant under the auto-automorphism group action. So these guys, the fields defining this U2 gauge field, are the same as the original ones. But here, I got this by a Z2 projection, if you want, on nodes of a D3 Dynkin diagram. So now, all the fields appearing in this U1 theory, U1 in quotation marks, is a sum of the fields of the original fields that you had at the beginning. Because everything's only defined on the twofold cover of one of the two complex planes. So now, if you want, all the fields that I'm writing now have an integer expansion, but that integer expansion is in z to the 1 over r, as opposed to z, where r is the order of the automorphism group action. So you need really to add two fields if you want to make sense here of this as a U1. And now all the D5 brain charge is written in terms of coweights and coroots. Now let's compute the partition function, which I'll call chi5d, of the 5d quiver gauge theory in the presence of the Wilson loop. This can be done by equivariant localization with respect to all the following equivariant parameters. So these are usually called Q and T. They're the space-time equivariant parameters. These are what I call Coulomb moduli of your 5D gauge theory. These are the gauge groups. These are called masses, and this is the flavor symmetry. And these are all the fermion masses. And this is the symmetry group of your Wilson loops, or Wilson loop singular. There's only one Wilson loop. Adding D1 brains doesn't give you more Wilson loops. It gives you a Wilson loop in more complicated representations. So there's only just one Wilson loop in this story. And then the partition function can be expressed in the spirit of equivalent localization as a sum over fixed point in instanton moduli space. This is the result. So let us assume in all generality that I put LA D1 brains wrapping the non-compact two-cycle SA star. Then you find that the partition function takes this, it looks a little bit nasty, but I'm going to explain what everything is here. And this is the form of the partition function. It's a sum over weights, and all the weights you're summing over, so it's actually a finite sum. It's a Laurent polynomial in a bunch of operators, and these operators are all called Y operators. We're going to define them in the next slides. But then the coefficient that accompany these Y operators look as follows. So the most important thing here is that all these things make up a character of what's called a finite dimensional irreducible representation of a quantum affine algebra. So this is kind of a surprise. In a very different context, people studied in the 90s quantum affine algebras and tried to build the finite dimensional irreducible representations. And so here, actually, you're constructing the character of all these representations as the partition function of of your setup with D1 brains and D5 brains. And the highest weight of a given representation is precisely this thing. So L1, L2, L3, up to Lm, that defines a weight in Dynkin labels, or a coweight, and that coweight is what I call the highest weight of the representation. So which D1 brains you put wrapping which non-compact two cycles defines for you the representation when you compute the partition function. This little integer I call dB omega is a positive integer that you get by a procedure called an SL2 string procedure. You start from the highest weight. How many simple roots do you need to subtract from the highest weight to reach a weight omega? That's the integer, how you determine that integer. Then there's a bunch of coefficients that only depend on the equivariant parameters Q and T for the rotation of the space-time. That's sometimes called the omega background parameters. And then you have 5D gauge couplings here. So this is also called in 5D instanton counting parameters. And then there's also a bunch of functions which are fundamental hypermultiplets. They look like this. And then the crux of the physics of the Wilson loop is in these Y operators. As this character of a representation organizes itself as a sum over the weights of this quantum affine algebra. So what it looks like is that every one of these operators is an expectation taken in an expectation value, looks like this. So here you might recognize what I call Z5D, is actually all the bulk physics of 5D Yang-Mills, what's sometimes called the Nekrasov partition function or the instanton partition function, without the presence of a Wilson loop. And then all the Wilson loop physics is encoded in this factor. So that's, again, Z is the fermion mass, and that's the only place where it appears. So the fermion mass for your quark moving in the circle of your dual cylinder appears here, and this factor encodes all of the physics. And so in practice, I'm going to show you some examples of partition functions. This is what it looks like. And you sum over, in this expectation value, m tuples of Young diagrams, one for each Coulomb factor. So for every equivariant parameter of the gauge group, you get a Young diagram. And basically, the instanton sum reorganizes itself as a sum over a Young tableau. But with this extra factor that takes care of the Wilson loop now. And so you have as many Young diagrams in this sum as there are Coulomb parameters. And the infinite product, as I said, is the contribution of the Wilson loop. Here, what I call x prime in the Wilson loop is defined as these variables, Coulomb parameters times some equivariant parameter for the space-time, length of a row of some of the partitions. This just comes out of computing the partition function. It's not very important. And then, as I told you, all the bulk physics in 5D is in this factor, in the absence of Wilson loop. So a few remarks. If you put only one D1 brain, so you have only one quark with fermion mass Z, or quark mass Z, the above partition function turns out to be a finite polynomial in Z. This is not true in if you put more D1 brains. So you only get a polynomial if you put one D1 brain, but in that case, you actually do get, and that's highly non-trivial. I mean, look at this. There's a Z in the denominator. There's a priori, it looks like there's poles in Z. Right? But the point is that if you're very careful and you actually try to see if there's a pole in that expression, that pole is canceled by some zero somewhere else in the partition function. And so actually that expression is pole-free in Z as long as I only have one D1 brain. The more D1 brains you put, the higher dimensional representations you get for your quantum affine algebra, you build just higher characters, symmetric representations. As opposed to just the fundamental ones, right? So if I put one D1 brain, you have a choice of where you want, which non-compact two-cycle you want that D1 brain to wrap. So if I put my D1 brain to wrap the first non-compact two-cycle, and you compute the partition function, you've computed the character of the first fundamental finite dimensional irreducible representation of UQ of G hat. Yes?
Not every representation of G lives through a representation of UQGF.
Yes.
So there's some kind of complicated selection.
Exactly, so I'm gonna get there. Actually, it's actually really interesting. So the way I derive this partition function is by doing the some modified ADHM prescription and being very careful about the poles. So you take your favorite pole prescription in the quantum mechanics of instantons with the presence of the Wilson loop, and if you do that carefully, maybe you use, the popular thing is the JK residue prescription, whatever. Pick whatever you want that computes your contour integral correctly. After you do that carefully, you do land actually on the physics that I think you're mentioning, if I understand correctly. So let me get there. So when the Lie algebra is of a simply laced type, ADE type, Nikita built this object and called it a QQ character using different methods than some ADHM integral. In this case, I think this formula describes equally well these non-simply laced characters. And so there is a sense in which, exactly. So you can also talk about G2, and I'll show you in a second. So here's the example of what the partition functions look like. So imagine I have an A1 theory. By this, I mean a single gauge group. So you have a singularity of type A1, you blow it up, you have a P1. That course, you know, you put as many D5 brains you want wrapping that P1. That's the number. If you put N D5 brains, you get a UN gauge group. And so the partition function in the presence of a Wilson loop, and here I'm only putting, let's say, one D1 brain in the setup, looks like this. It looks like the sum of two terms, one which is the expectation value of that Y operator that I wrote here, this complicated mess. And then there's a second term shifted by one unit of instanton, one instanton shifted, which looks like the expectation value of 1 over Y, basically, times some matter function. This thing is just a fundamental hyper. And this expression is pole-free in Z. You can check this. There's many different methods to check it, but it's pole-free in Z. So the reason why we call this a character of SU2 should be, by analogy, or like a quantum affine SU2, you can think of, imagine I don't have this capital Q function, or in this instanton counting parameter. So this is, technically we'd call this a twisted character, I think, if you were to be really honest. But imagine you just don't have fundamental matter in your system, just a compact P1, and that's it. And you put D5 brains wrapping that. And no D5 brain will wrap the non-compact two cycles. Only the D1 brain will. Then, this looks a lot like Y plus 1 over Y. As if I ask you what is the fundamental character of SU2, or like the spin 1/2 representation character, you'll tell me, oh, it's X plus X inverse. So in that spirit, now promote the Ys to operators, very complicated operators, taken in expectation values. That's how they arise in quantum affine algebra. But that gives you a little bit of intuition why I'm talking about characters of quantum affine algebra. Here for A2, I have two P1s. So now I have a choice if I look at fundamental representation, where do I put my D1 brain? Do I want a D1 brain wrapping the non-compact two cycle attached to the first node or the second node? Well, if you put a D1 brain on the first node, you get this character. This is called the first fundamental character of A2, or quantum affine A2. And this is the second fundamental character, where you put a D1 brain on node 2. And then you can put as many D1 brains on both nodes, and you'd get some very complicated mix, which is like some tensor product, in some sense of but in the sense of quantum affine algebras, which is harder to do than tensor products in Lie algebras. But that's completely tractable. This procedure of just computing the partition function works for any amount of D1 brains. Here's a more non-trivial example where I do G2. So G2 also has two nodes. But so now I start with a D4 singularity, and I do this operation where I identify the three outer nodes, as I've described, and then you can make sense, I think, of a non-simply laced G2 quiver theory, where I have like two unitary gauge group and a weird bifundamental in between them, there's no Lagrangian for it, but there is an instanton counting prescription for it. There's a quantum mechanics description for the instanton moduli space, et cetera, but there is no Lagrangian for it. And so, then you compute the partition function. What do you get? You get something that has a total of 7 terms, and you can check in the literature. This is what people call the first fundamental character of G2, quantum affine G2. And Langlands dual G2, which is the same because G2 is self-dual under Langland duality. But nonetheless, it exchanges short and long roots. So you get a flipped quiver. It's kind of that just comes out of the computation. And then you can also put a D1 brain on the outer nodes of your D4 singularity. And then you get the second fundamental after projection, the second fundamental character. And now you get 15 terms, which I don't have the courage to write in one slide. But if you're a G2 expert, or I don't know if there's such a thing, but if you like G2, then it should strike you maybe that there might be a mistake, or maybe as you pointed out, there isn't, because the second fundamental representation of G2 is 14-dimensional. And here you get 15 terms. But that's also because When you decompose the, as you said, the fundamental representation, here the second fundamental representation of quantum affine G2 in terms of G2 representations, you don't get a fundamental representation as the 14, you have to add a trivial representation, which in this case comes as a null weight or an extra null weight, and that naturally just comes out of doing the pole integral. So you produce that term by construction. If you want another way to phrase it is that computing the ADHM contour integral forces on you that you get 15 terms. So you don't actually, so by design, you land literally on, you know, like, so again, this matches with some conformal field theory. People have computed characters of G2, quantum affine G2. They had 15 terms, and they match precisely with what you get here from 5D gauge theory. Of course, they don't have instantons or whatever. I mean, what they call these Y functions is very different from what I call the Y function, because I'm talking about gauge theory. But I'm going to make contact with what people call Y functions in conformal field theory in a second. And to do that, I'm going to have to do a duality to three dimensions. So very briefly, I'm not going to go into too much detail, but the duality to three dimensions comes from turning on vortex flux on the D5 brains. And that's known as Higgsing or gauge vortex duality. Different people use different terms in the literature. And what happens is that basically on the Higgs phase of the 5D theory, now you freeze all the Coulomb moduli of your 5D theory. And the hypermultiplets can get non-zero expectation values. That's the Higgs branch. And the place where the Coulomb and Higgs branch meet is called the root of the Higgs branch. And let's describe this first in terms of the geometry. So what I have in mind here is that at first in the 5D theory, if you have a D5 brain wrapping a compact two cycle and another D5 brain distinct that wraps a non-compact two cycle, at the root of the Higgs branch, you can trade this for a single D5 brain that wraps only the non-compact two cycle, but this is not the same non-compact two cycle as this one. It's basically the sum of the two, the sum of this compact two cycle and non-compact two cycle class. Gives you a class, which I call SI star. So the D5 brains recombine. Now that you are at the root of the Higgs branch, what you can do, and this is where the duality to 3D comes in, you can turn on vortex flux on the D5 brains. For each Coulomb parameter that you had in 5D, you can turn on some units of vortex flux. That's like turning on some units of first churn class. It's now non-zero. This induces a shift of the corresponding Coulomb moduli. So that's a result by Nekrasov and Witten that showed that actually, if you work in omega background, so like you have some, here I have C2, my spacetime is C2, but I make it compact, it's not compact. So in theory, I should get an infinite answer for the instanton partition function. But what I get, Nekrasov makes sense of this by introducing this omega background, which is an alternative to compactification. And in this omega background, you can really trade turning on vortex flux does not mean that you're putting surface defects in the theory. It only means that you're now shifting what used to be Coulomb equals mass at the root of the Higgs branch, where you freeze the Coulomb parameters to the root of the Higgs to be equal to the masses. Now you're only shifting by some units of the equivariant parameter for the spacetime, t. So if I have two equivariant parameters, q and t, for the spacetime. I'll show you which one is t, but all you're doing when you're turning on vortex flux with omega background is that actually you're just shifting your Coulomb parameters by some integer units of t, or like power of t, 5D notation. So you're not putting a new vertex operator or like something like some new vortex, some actual new defect. All you're doing is basically you're going back on the Coulomb branch at integer values. So these EA before were moduli, were U1 moduli, and now you froze them to masses that are fixed. They're parameters of your theory, not moduli. But now by turning on these vortex flux that are integers, you can reprobe the Coulomb branch at integer values. Okay, so on a lattice that has spacing T, if you want, okay? So turning on n units of vortex flux on the D5 brains has a different description in string theory. It turns out also that instead of talking about the vortex from the 5D, from the D5 brain point of view, you can also talk about D3 brains that end on D5 brains, because a D3 brain ending on a D5 brain is precisely a vortex. So these D3 brains, you can actually make sense of them in the resolved singularity X as follows. So now this is my updated picture to make contact with 3D. All the non-compact cycle and compact cycle that were wrapped by D5 brains recombined into non-compact cycles only. So all my D5 brains now are wrapping some non-compact 2 cycles. And I'm introducing by hand N D3 brains wrapping the compact 2 cycles, which is equivalent in gauge theory to turning on N units of vortex flux. And the D1 brains are completely unaffected by what you're doing. They just live their life, and that's fine. So if you only consider the D3 brains, the gauge theory on them has 3D n equal 4 supersymmetry. You start with 16 supercharges, like that's your just type 2B on AD. With the D3 brains in, you get the 3D n equal 4 theory on the D3 brains. You add the D5 brains in the picture, these were the original D5 brains from before, you break SUSY further by 2. And now you get a 3D n equal 2 theory. And so to determine that 3D theory, you can start from the geometry, like we did in 5D, and you find, like before, due to Douglas and Moore, and you follow the analysis, that at low energies, the theory on the D3 brains this time is a 3D quiver gauge theory of with n equal 2 supersymmetry, and that 3D theory lives on only one of the two complex planes and wraps the dual cylinder, just like in 5D. Notice that this 3D theory, the D3 brains are a point on one of the other planes. And this distinguishes what I call T here. So this is the units of vortex flux, T. T is the parameter for this plane that is right here. So the vortex is the unit, when you turn on vortices, the vortex is measured out of the D3 brains. The actual plane wrapped by the D3 brains is this one. And then the amount of vortex flux you turn on is measured by units in this equivariant parameter. Okay. So here's what it looks like in practice. Here's an example. If I have a starting 5D theory that for whatever reason looks like this, in 3D, your 3D n equal 2 theory looks something like this in this very specific case. And so this goes by various names, actually. In particular, so the Higgs branch of this quiver gauge theory in 3 dimension is called the moduli space of vortices in physics. I think in mathematics, this is called the moduli space of quasimaps. But so this has been analyzed in mathematics by Nakajima and analyzed in physics in various contexts. But this is the 3D theory you get out of 5D is fixed by this procedure of Higgsing or just turning on flux that describes this theory for you. So in particular, the matter content you had in 5D describes the chiral and anti-chiral multiplets in 3D, and these N1, N2, Nm are just the units of vortex flux. But these are up to you. How much you want to turn vortex flux is what you get here, like these numbers. But these numbers are fixed, 1, 1, 1, 1, by the data of the 5D theory on top. Now we have the D1 brains. The D1 brains break supersymmetry again. And by the same argument as we had before, where the D1 brains, we thought of them as wrapping the T-dual cylinder and points everywhere else, and we said they're Wilson loops. Here, they're again Wilson loops of the 3D theory. And so by the same exact argument, these D1 brains are Wilson loops, half BPS, of the theory that lives on these D3 brains. And the configuration with all brains present now only has 2 supercharges. Let's compute the partition function of the 3D theory, just like we did in 5D, in the presence of these Wilson loop, which I call defect. And this can be done, again, using localization. You pick your favorite method to compute the 3D partition function. And here I'll take a shortcut, because I've already worked hard for you for 45 minutes to motivate how you do it in 5D, instead of doing it from scratch in 3D. I'm going to just take the 5D answer and specialize the Coulomb parameters to be frozen to masses, turn on vortex flux in 5D, and land directly on the 3D answer. So something really nice happens, actually. So this is like a nice surprise, but There's, if you just look at the Wilson loop physics in 5D, and you impose now freezing the Coulomb parameters in 5D to be equal to masses, and you turn on vortex flux N, then the 5D Wilson loop, the 5D Wilson loop physics factorizes into new Wilson loop physics, but now that you have to reinterpret in 3D. So this factor in 5D is now interpreted in 3D as some factor that comes from quantizing D3, D1 strings, and this factor here that comes from quantizing D1, D5 strings. So there's some nice factorization that just comes out of specializing what we call X prime when you turn on vortex flux. And the rest of the partition function, the bulk of the partition function, actually truncates. Before, we were summing over Young diagrams with arbitrary length and arbitrary number of rows, all possible Young diagrams. After you turn on vortex flux, something also miraculous happens. The Young diagrams cannot have more than n rows, where n is the amount of vortex flux you turned on. So now that you've turned on vortex flux, say n, you cannot have Young diagrams with more rows than n. That's something, the partition function is zero otherwise. Right, so it's only counting contributions with rows less than n. And so these two things put together, we recompute the partition function in 3D, and what do we find? We find that the partition function is again a twisted character of a quantum affine representation, irreducible finite dimensional representation of UQ Langlands dual G hat. And the highest weight of that representation is once again purely determined by which D1 brains you put where in your setup. So all the physics of the representation of the quantum affine algebra that you have is encoded in the D1 brains, the Wilson loop. Again, these integers are figured out from this procedure. You start from the highest weight, you subtract a number of simple positive roots, and you get a different weight in that representation. And so that's how you figure out the integers. And this time you have to be careful. What used to be the 5D gauge coupling is now a 3D Fayet-Leopoldus parameter. So it is in the dictionary, when you start in 5D and you have a gauge coupling, from the point of view of the 3D gauge theory, that clearly is not a gauge coupling, or it certainly is not the 5D gauge coupling. What is it in 3D? It becomes the Fayet-Leopoldus parameter. So now you have a new character with different physics, which looks very similar to the previous one in five dimensions, nonetheless has some differences. And now in particular, all these Y operators, which encoded all the actual physics of the Wilson loop, in three dimensions can be represented as an integral. So before, in five dimension, I represented the expectation value of these Y operators I introduced as a sum over partitions. In three dimensions, you can do something different. You can also write the answer in terms of an integral over the Coulomb moduli of the 3D theory. This is called Coulomb branch localization. And so here in this presentation, the Wilson loop physics is here. It looks very similar to 5D, except now I have a finite product. The bulk physics in the absence of Wilson loops is here in this function Z3D. So this encodes all the physics of the 3D n equal to quiver gauge theory in the absence of Wilson loops. And this is a Y operator. If you evaluate that integral, you end up with a sum over partitions, where each one of the partitions is labeled by a Young diagram with at most n rows. This is because now you're right, I mean, there's a new parameter n, the vortex flux. So if you actually evaluate this integral, you can recover the 5D way of writing it, but truncated. Here's an example. So suppose you start in 5D with a theory that's U1 with two flavors. The partition function looks like a sum of two terms, y plus 1 over y, as before. That's just the same thing I had written before for A1 singularity. In 3D, the theory on the vortex, the partition function now looks like a sum of two terms. And you have like y plus 1 over y again, but these y's are defined differently. And there's now different matter factors, but still in spirit, it looks like y plus 1 over y, which is why you can call it the character of a finite dimensional irreducible representation of a quantum affine algebra. But twisted, and twisted differently than in 5D. And now I'm going to tell you how you recover exactly this formula, say, or any more general one for Lie algebra, for any simple algebra from W algebra. So I have 5 minutes, that should be enough. So let G be a simple Lie algebra. What we call TODA field theory can be written in terms of rank G free bosons in 2 dimensions with a background charge that you write as follows, and the TODA potential that couples them. And so that's the action that we call TODA action, which I won't use, so we won't worry about it, but that's just to give you a bit of background on where I'm going. Because this TODA CFT happens to have, the kinetic term is here, this is the background curvature of your Riemann surface on which TODA is defined, the background charge that couples the TODA potential here as a B, and that B parameter appears in Q. So that's why this potential term here couples the bosons and Q. And the symmetry of this TODA theory is called W algebra symmetry. It's an extended conformal symmetry, and so it has the stress tensor of Virasoro, but also higher spin currents. In 97, Frankel and Reshetykin defined a deformed W algebra, deformation with 2 parameters, they call Q and T. The notation is not innocent. I'm using Q and T because there will be a relation between these and the omega background parameters in 5 dimensions, Q and T. Or in 3D, the omega background parameter on the plane of the D3 brains where they live, and the vortex flux parameter T, transverse to the D3 brain. So the way they construct their W algebra, I'll go through this extremely briefly because the details are not important. I'll just give you the result and we'll end there. You start with a deformed Heisenberg algebra with the following generators, which are defined by Frankel and Reshetykin to have the following commutator. So you see, it looks like some kind of deformed deformation by Q and T of what you'd expect for regular Heisenberg algebra to just be commutator of 2 generators is just proportional to the Cartan matrix. But here it's deformed, it looks nasty. And this thing here is a deformed Cartan matrix, which they also define. You can construct a Fock space representation of your Heisenberg algebra as follows. You start with a weight in the Cartan subalgebra of G, and the Fock representation is generated by a vector such that this is the eigenvalue that you get by acting with the zeroth mode of alpha A on lambda. And so it spits out this eigenvalue. So that's like your highest weight, and then that builds your Fock space representation. What you call the W algebra is defined as the thing that commutes with all the screening charges which act on this lambda. So it is generated by vertex operators that commute with Q. That's the definition. And so here this little s labels the spin of my current for my W algebra. So if I have a A1 W algebra, that's sometimes called Liouville theory, then you have deformed Liouville theory with a deformed stress energy tensor, which is a nasty looking vertex operator, but it exists. If you consider an A2 TODA theory, you can build 2 operators. You can build a stress tensor and a spin 3 tensor. Sometimes that's called the Zamolodchikov algebra, et cetera, et cetera. You can do it for G2, for whatever. So any simple Lie algebra works the same way. And you can build a deformed stress tensor and higher spin currents for all these guys. In practice, they look like this. This is just to show you a screening charge. It looks like the integral of a screening current. This looks a lot like the usual free field formalism, undeformed. Sometimes that's called Coulomb-Gauss formalism, Dotsenko-Fateyev formalism, whichever you prefer. But for the deformed setting, the only way to define these guys, as far as I know, is in the free field formalism. So that's all that's known. And in fact, that's all we'll need. So we don't need more. But in free field formalism, this looks like that. So these are an example of a screening current. There is no definition of a primary vertex operator in the literature. So we'll consider what I call a generic vertex operator, which is built out of like the most, I mean, just a collection of weights in the algebra that's arbitrary, or co-weights if you consider just a non-simply Lie algebra. And so you get a bunch of operators to build your vertex operators. They're multiplication of these guys and that guys. That's not too important. If you want to recover the usual W algebras, there's a limit you can take, which is T equals Q to the gamma, and you send Q to 1. So gamma stays fixed in that limit. What you get back is the undeformed W algebra where gamma is related to the central charge of the CFT. And so all the vertex operators become regular vertex operator of TODA. The screening currents become the usual screening currents. And the Virasoro stress tensor and all the higher spin currents become what you literally call the stress tensor of Liouville, the stress tensor of WN, whichever. So my interest, and we're almost done, is in computing the following chiral correlators. A bunch of vertex operators, a bunch of screenings, and a bunch of generating currents. Well, these screening charges are integrals of screening currents. So actually, this correlator looks like a giant integral where you have m or two, or like times na integrals. You have a lot of integrals. So you have to specify the contour of integration in your correlator. This can be done very explicitly. And because you're working in free field, everything is written in terms of free bosons. This complicated correlator, you just do weak contractions. It's just a multiplication of two-point functions. That's what free field gives you and this free boson formulation. This is what you find after you compute, by weak contraction, the correlator. You find that it is up to some proportionality constant that we can discuss, but whatever, but up to that proportionality constant that is, I think, not very important here, you get literally all the partition function of the 3D theory in presence of a Wilson loop. Literally, you get on the nose. So that means the correlator is the partition function of the 3D gauge theory in the presence of the Wilson loop. So if you remember, this was the form of the 3D partition function. It looked very different from a correlator. But if you're careful, then you can identify every one of the factors in the 3D partition function with some two-point in deformed TODA theory, or deformed W algebras. So screenings with themselves, screenings with vertex operators, these give all the bulk 3D physics, and all the Wilson loop physics comes from stress tensors with screenings or stress tensors with vertex operators. So that's all the Wilson loop physics. And then what I call the 3D Faye-Leopoulos term, or the 5D gauge coupling, this just looks like this. This is just what I call here this eigenvalue here. In the TODA theory, this is how, you know, when you build your Fock space and you start with a weight lambda and you act on it with alpha is zero, you spit out this eigenvalue. That eigenvalue is the 3D FI parameter. I think we're done, so let me just conclude. So here's an example of what this looks like in practice. If I have TODA theory on the cylinder, you put a bunch of screenings. These are the D3 brains in string theory. You put a stress tensor, say, in Liouville theory. That's the D1 brain. And you put a bunch of vertex operators, that's the D5 brains. And so that's why you have a correspondence between 3D gauge theory with D5, D3, D1, and a correlator in TODA. This is an example of such a correlator. Okay, and if you actually perform the integral by a contour integral, because this, as I told you, is a bunch of integral, then you find, by evaluating by residue, that the correlator is equal to the 5D partition function, which is written as a sum over fixed points, which are Young diagrams in instanton moduli space. But the Coulomb parameters are precisely restricted to be equal to masses shifted by some units of t. So that's that just means you turned on vortex flux. And so here what you see is you have Coulomb parameters frozen with vortex flux turned on. So that's the 5D at the gauge vortex locus. And so that's very consistent with what we'd expect, because this guy is the 3D partition function. And so if it's the 3D partition function, it better be equal to the 5D1 at the duality locus to 3D. So it's very consistent. Thank you. Sorry?
We'll be around tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, I'm here, tomorrow.
Okay, let's thank Nathan again.